Face it, shaker bottles suck. Your protein shake always comes out clumpy and you look like an idiot using the thing. That's why I decided to ditch my shaker bottle for good and get myself a BlendJet 2 portable blender. It makes perfectly blended protein shakes that come out smooth, creamy, and delicious in just 20 seconds. So go to BlendJet.com and use promo code DECASTPOD at checkout to get 12% off your order. That's promo code DECASTPOD to get 12% off your order at checkout.
Have you ever wanted to learn a new language but just didn't have the time or money? I may have a solution for you. Her name is Jessica, and she gives free Chinese lessons 7 days a week at 11 p.m. Beijing time and 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Chinese is easy and fun if you have the right teacher. Let Jessica be that teacher and introduce yourself to the fastest growing language in the job market today. Just go to tinyurl.com/TCJessica and tell her Ian sent you. Hello and welcome to the DeathCast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our third look at the West Memphis 3. Before we get into it this week, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you would like to follow the show on social media, just search for the DeathCast, DeathCast Podcast, or DeathCast Pod. You can find me on most social media platforms under one of those monikers. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple ways you can do that. First and easiest is to go to your favorite podcast app, leave a 5-star review, and subscribe. Second way you can do that is to go to buymeacoffee.com/the+deathcast and make a donation to the show. No amount is too small, and obviously no amount is too big. And if you'd like to get early ad-free access to these shows, you can go to tinyurl.com/decastpatreon. For exclusive content, I'm going to be putting up archived episodes here in the future, but I'm also putting up the shows earlier than they hit the main feed with all the ads removed. But there's more coming. I have had a number of people reach out and ask me to recover cases that I have covered in the past. And I've been thinking about it, and I believe that I am going to really start pushing the Patreon page and putting these redos on certain cases that people want to hear me go over again on the Patreon feed only. So it's exclusive content, and that way I can keep the main feed nice, new, and fresh. Alright, now that all of that's out of the way, get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfy chair, kick back, and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. We left off last week discussing all of the various stays that Damien had partaken in mental institutions, as well as the stories that came out about him, the things that he was getting up to in West Memphis. Specifically after he returned to the area from Oregon. The stalking of young girls, threatening to kill them, that type of thing. Make it really clear, Damien Echols, by this point, was 18 years old. He was targeting much younger children to terrorize. And if you're one of those who believes that he is in fact guilty for the crimes that he was convicted for, this gives a history of that type of behavior, of this targeting and terrorizing those younger than him. I am aware there's a lot of people out there who discount this idea that Damien and Jason and Jesse were all innocents who were railroaded. There is no proof for that. I had one group on Twitter come at me, or no, I'm sorry, X now, come at me and say Jesse had been coerced into his confessions by the police, and that's why his story kept changing, and that he had been offered a deal by the prosecution. Not true. You can go to Callahan and look it up for yourself. Jesse, in his own words, before prosecutors, stated that he had not been offered any type of deal by the prosecution for giving his confession. This was after the Bible confession. You read the statements for the officers that brought Jesse to prison after his conviction. Guess what? Despite the narrative you're trying to tell, they did not coerce Jesse Miskelly into giving the confession that he gave inside of the police cruiser. They spoke to him just as they did any other prisoner, and Jesse is the one who offered up that information. Now, Jesse has gone back well after the fact and refuted this, but that's the reality. And if police did coerce him, as you like to say, that's their job, is to get a confession from an individual that is guilty of a crime. There is nothing unethical about that. There's nothing illegal about that. It would be illegal if they fed Jesse information about the crimes prior to his having made the confession, but that's not what happened in any single confession that he made. Jesse gave information. Upon another retelling of the story, he would change some of that information, and if you look at his confessions, the first few confessions were very slanted to minimize his involvement and activity in these murders. That's not the actions of someone with diminished mental capacity. That is the action of someone who understands that they did wrong. They're going to get in a lot of trouble for it, and it would be in their best interest to make their part in it as small as possible. You look over the confessions, you move through them, you can see that with each confession, Jesse gets more and more honest, not only about what happened, but also about his role in these murders. And I know there's others who say, oh, they couldn't have been involved in it. Jesse wasn't that kind of kid. Bullshit. Bullshit. Jesse's had a rap sheet frickin' as long as my arm by the time of these crimes. And almost every single instance involved him assaulting others. So yes, it is very likely and was proven in court that Jesse Miskelly was not only capable of doing this type of act, as he targeted younger children to bully, he did, in fact, involve himself with this act. Remind everyone, the main sources for information for this series are the trio of books by Gary Meese, as well as the case file archives over at callahan.mysite.com. We're going to briefly look at some of the activities that Miskelly had been involved with prior to the murders. It's known that in January of 1992, he accosted a boy on the train tracks northwest of the Lakeshore Trailer Park. Now, there were at least five witnesses to this assault. Now, according to this 14-year-old, he and some other boys were on the railroad tracks when they heard others approaching, and they just got that feeling that maybe they should hide. According to this individual, in a statement given in September of 1993, quote, Jason, Damien, Jesse, Buddy, and four other boys were with them, and so Jesse shoved me against the side. Jesse was first talking to me, and then after a while, Jesse took a knife out of his pocket and put a knife to my throat. He said, would you like to be dead? And so he shoved the knife harder, and so he put the knife up, and then Jesse hit me, and Buddy too, and I couldn't tell who all was hitting me. Damien and Jason and the other boys were still on the railroad tracks, and there he was yelling at me, and then they all left. I walked home. I was coughing up blood. Now, this story in and of itself may be true. There is no way to verify, however, that Damien and Jason were there. It's very possible there's conflicting stories about their relationship. Damien and Jason like to say that they did not know Miss Kelly really prior to any of this, other than the fact that they had seen him around different places and knew him to be a troublemaker. However, those who were interviewed leading up to the trial, as investigation was ongoing, paint a picture that was in stark contrast to that. Namely, that the three of them did hang out quite often. So, while I believe this story probably did happen, it's a little on the fence as to whether or not the other two murderers were in fact there. Another individual who actually witnessed the assault on this 14-year-old was a girl who gave a statement to police on October 17th, 1993. This was about another incident involving Miss Kelly. Quote, "We had gotten into an argument and he had been spreading a rumor around that he was having sexual intercourse with me to all these people, and I confronted him with it and he just kept saying it. All this stuff, so I slapped him. For a year, I didn't hear anything from him, and somebody came up to me and said that he had been looking for me, and so I just didn't worry about it. And one day, I was walking through the park, and he was at the road, and he came up to me. He started running at me, and my boyfriend stepped in front of him, and he hit Carl. He hit Carl, and then he hit me, and we started to walk away, and he started coming after us again. So we ran until one of my friend's parents came out and got us and took me to my house." There is an actual police complaint about this dated March 12th of 1993, which is after the incident took place. In the original complaint, it stated that this girl's mother actually went to the Miss Kelly home after he had assaulted this girl and her boyfriend, and that while she was standing at the front door, Jesse Jr. ran out the back. The mother further went on to state that Jesse Miss Kelly Sr. informed her that there was nothing that he could do about his son. This same girl also stated that Jesse's girlfriend at the time, another young girl by the name of Susie Brewer, had made threats to her, basically saying if you get Jesse into any trouble with the police, then she, Jesse, and all of their other friends were going to hunt her down. Other incidents that involved Miss Kelly include throwing a rock at a little girl and hitting her in the head, which prompted a call to the police. At the time of the murders, Miss Kelly was actually on probation for this particular assault. On May 4th, 1988, when Miss Kelly was 11 years old, he was accused of hitting another little girl in the head either with a brick or a rock. In this police report, it stated that the fight began after Miss Kelly began, quote-unquote, beating up her abusive boyfriend, and the young girl had jumped on Miss Kelly's back. There are further incidents going back. Miss Kelly stabbed a classmate when he was in fourth grade with a pencil. So the idea that Miss Kelly's just, you know, this misunderstood young man, I'm sorry, it honestly has to be smashed. Miss Kelly had a long history of involvement with both the law as well as social services, as Jesse was known to be violent and out of control. One report dated from June of 1987 says, "He gets so mad, he's capable of hurting someone." This report also goes on to detail an incident wherein Jesse described the stitches that were in his hand, which he said had come from him punching soda bottles. Later in the report, it states, "Mrs. Miss Kelly reported Jesse does not own up to his wrongs, that he always blames someone else. She denies Jesse becomes physical with her or her husband, but will clench his fist and take his anger out on someone else or something, like breaking a window." Jesse's mother, Shelbia, told this social worker, "I don't think he can control his temper. He needs some help." And at this point, now we are shifting focus. we're going to move ahead in the timeline of events. Don't worry, we will be coming back to discuss certain things later on in this series. We now have a basic general idea of the three culprits. We need to look at the date in question, May 5th of 1993, which was a Wednesday. Now, we have our three victims, all 8 years old in second grade. That would be Michael Moore, Stevie Branch, and Christopher Byers. They lived in a lower middle class neighborhood in West Memphis, which, if you look at a map of West Memphis, appears it was in the southern area of the city in relation to where the boys' bodies would be found. Now, Christopher and Michael lived across the street from each other, very close to the school. According to statements later given, Stevie's mother, Pam Hobbs, had picked Stevie up from Weaver Elementary School at approximately 2:55 p.m., and the two of them have walked home. Not long after this, Michael Moore had approached the home of the Branch family and asked if Stevie could go out and play with him. Pam informed Stevie that he could go play, but he had to be home by 4:30, which was right before she left for work. It's known that Stevie was riding a green bicycle that had been given to him by his grandfather 2 weeks prior, that grandfather being Jackie Hicks. Well, Michael Moore was riding a 20-inch black Renegade bicycle. He's also known to have been wearing his Boy Scout uniform, something that he was very proud of. Keep that in mind, this Boy Scout uniform, because it does come up later in the case. There are some questions as to why he was wearing it, whether or not there was a meeting that night, and whatnot. So after Stevie and Michael go out, they ride around the neighborhood doing typical 8-year-old boy things. Now at 3:10, John Mark Byers, who is the stepfather of Christopher Byers, arrives home. And he would later tell police that when he got home, Christopher was not there. About 20 minutes after this, Christopher's brother, Ryan, arrives home at 3:30. And he would tell police that Christopher did not have a key to the home and was in fact supposed to wait outside, I believe in the carport, for his brother to get home so that he could go inside. Now, between 4 and 5:30 p.m., a couple of things happened. John Mark Byers drops Ryan off at the courthouse where the boy had an appointment before going on to pick up Christopher's mother and his wife, Melissa. They arrived home at approximately 5:20 to find that Christopher was still not home, although they did state that they found evidence that he had been there. Not long after this, John Byers leaves the house to go pick Ryan up, and along the way he spots Christopher playing with his skateboard and makes him get into the vehicle. John then drives Christopher home and, by his own admission, gave the boy, quote, 2 or 3 licks with a belt as punishment for disobeying both John Mark Byers and his wife Melissa and going out when he had been explicitly told to stay home. John then orders the young boy to clean their carport and heads off to go pick Ryan up. John Mark Byers stated the last time he saw Christopher was roughly 5:30 in the afternoon, and Christopher was in the process of doing as he had been instructed. Approximately 6 p.m., Diana Moore, which was the mother of Michael Moore, later stated that she saw three boys, her son, Stevie Branch, and Christopher Byers, all playing together. Two of the boys were on bicycles. The fourth had a skateboard. Some accounts differ on these things specifically, and by that I mean some state that Christopher Byers was actually riding on the back of one of the boys' bikes, standing on the pegs, other that he was riding beside them on his skateboard. In any event, at 6:30 p.m., John Mark Byers returned home with Ryan, only to discover that Christopher was not there. Upon going into the house, they discovered that Christopher's mother, Lissa, was on the phone and was unaware that her youngest child had, in fact, left the house again. So, Ryan, Melissa, and John leave the house to search for Christopher. Now, John Mark Byers told the police later that he encountered an officer as he cruised around the neighborhood and informed him of his stepson's disappearance. He stated that this officer told him that they would have to wait until 8 p.m. in order to be able to file a missing persons report. You will find some websites online that state that, you know, this is evidence that John Mark Byers was involved in it because police give top priority to missing children. Not in 1993, they don't. I lived through the 90s. I can absolutely guarantee you they did not. The people that state this are viewing things from a more recent mindset than the reality at the time, which was children ran and played in the streets, and oftentimes their parents had no idea where they were. And even if their parents did contact law enforcement or encounter law enforcement, oftentimes they were told that they needed to wait and see if the child came home before the police could or would take any action. And yes, it was like this in 1993, especially in Arkansas. Stevie Branch's family, that'd be his mother, Pam Hobbs, and his stepfather, Terry Hobbs, give a very similar accounting of their afternoon. After Pam informed her son that he needed to be home at 4:30, the family, while worried about the fact that he had not returned home, went on with business as usual, thinking that, you know, he's going to be there when we get back, and, you know, he's going to get into some trouble for disobeying us, but he'll be there. So some point before 5 p.m., Terry Hobbs takes Pam to her job at Catfish Island Restaurant. Now, they did do a brief search for Stevie along the way, but they did not see him. After dropping Pam off at the restaurant, Terry continues to look for Stevie before returning home. Now, Terry's story is going to get fleshed out a little more once we start getting into statements from the police, but I want to give you the timeline of events as we know they took place. According to Dana Moore, she saw her son Michael leave the house at roughly 3:10 p.m. and had seen him in the hours after that in the company of both Stevie and Christopher. She did state that on at least one occasion she had attempted to get Michael's attention, but he was too far away to notice her. She also stated that she informed Michael when he left that he needed to be home before the streetlights came on, which during this time of year was roughly 6 p.m., which is the last time that she stated she saw the three boys. According to Dana Moore, Chris and Stevie were sharing a ride while Mark rode his own bike. This was at East Barton and 14th Street, which is where the Moore family lived during this period of time. And Michael's father, Todd Moore, was out of the area during this period of time. He was a truck driver. Again, according to Mrs. Moore, somewhere around 6 o'clock, she asked her daughter, Dawn, to go find Michael and let him know that it was time for him to come home and have dinner. And this is where we're going to start getting into various witnesses. According to one witness, Deborah O'Tinger, she saw the three boys walking through her backyard between 5:45 and 6 p.m. pushing a bicycle. Another neighbor, Brian Woody, said that he saw four boys going into Robin Hood Hills between 6:30 and 6:45, stating that two of the boys were pushing bicycles, while another had a skateboard and the fourth child trailed far behind the others. Now, we know that John Mark Byers is the first parent to contact the police. We know that after the three members of the Byers family went out in search of Christopher, they went back to the house, at which point John Mark Byers contacted the sheriff's department because they had a search and rescue unit. And the sheriff's department informed John that he needed, in fact, to contact the West Memphis Police Department, which he did at roughly 8 p.m., The West Memphis Police Department dispatched Officer Regina Meeks to the home in order to take a statement. She arrived at the Byers home at 8:10, taking a report before calling the missing child in. Now, as Officer Meeks is preparing to leave the home, Dana Moore knocks on the door and informs the Byers that her son is also missing, stating that she had seen Michael in the presence of Stevie and Christopher just after 6 p.m. Now, according to Dana, she had actually been in contact with Terry Hobbs, and that Terry had actually been looking for his stepson as far back as 4:30, 5 o'clock. At 8 p.m., Ryan and John Mark Byers began a door-to-door search for the missing boys, learning along the way from a young boy and girl that they, along with their mother, had seen the three missing children going into Robin Hood Hills around 6:30. So, Byers and Ryan return to the house as Dana continues looking for them. Somewhere around 8:30 is when Terry Hobbs shows up on the scene, and we know from his own statements that he had in fact been out looking for the boys. Again, we're going to get into that more later, because Terry Hobbs is an individual in this case that has drawn a lot of attention and some controversy, and I personally feel he deserves his own section just to discuss everything concerning him. In any event, Hobbs is said to have told the other parents that he was going to start widening the search parameters. And quoting John Mark Byers, he was going to spread out down, you know, woods where they were found. I don't know how far down that way he went, but he was going to look that way. After this encounter with Hobbs, John Mark Byers, who was wearing shorts and flip-flops, returned home to put on clothing more suitable for searching in the woods and swampland for their boys. He borrows a flashlight from a neighbor by the name of Robert Fountain. Byers heads off in the direction of Robin Hood Hills. This is around 9:30, 9:40 at night at this point, and he encounters an officer named John Moore, who agrees to accompany John Mark Byers down in Robin Hood Hills, where the two men can search the area with their flashlight. Byers later stated that Moore went down the embankment to where the water was standing in Robin Hood Hills and shined his light down there, and that Moore informed him that it didn't look as though anybody had been down there. They did discover two sets of bicycle tracks. Outside of that, though, there was no information. Buyers later estimated the time that they came out of the woods to be around 10:30 or a quarter to 11, and that Officer Moore had informed him that he should go home for a few minutes and contact the police station in order to get an update on the status of the report filed by Meek. Moore arrived home at 11, contacted the police station, and spoke with Officer Meek, who put out an alert concerning the three boys. Before contacting the sheriff's department, once again trying to get the search and rescue team to come out, Byers then left the home and continued to search. Bringing Ryan with him, they drove to the Blue Beacon truck stop, which if you look at a map of the area, is to the left of Robin Hood Hills. Byers said that they parked their car with the lights shining into the woods and began honking the horn and hollering for the boys in an effort to draw them out. All of this is going on. Stevie Branch's mother, Pam, had contacted her father, Jackie Hicks, who had come down to help with the search. So after talking to some of the employees at the Blue Beacon, Byers and Ryan leave, and it's at this point that Byers encounters Jackie Hicks, Melissa, Dana, Terry Hobbs, and a friend of Hobbs who has later been presumed to have been David Jacoby. So they're standing out there in the street trying to figure out what the hell is going on, what they can do, where their children can be. And according to Byers, after this meeting of the minds, it was decided that they should, more probably than not, go back through Robin Hood Hills again to see if they can find any trace of the boys. At roughly 1:30 to 2 a.m., the group encountered a police officer who pulled up and informed them that a full-scale search was underway. A friend of Byers by the name of Tony Hudson came on the scene at somewhere around this point to help with the search efforts. Byers investigated an abandoned house that was in the area, and then Hudson, Byers, and Melissa drove out to the service road that witnesses would later claim they saw Damien Eccles walking on. Now, this service road runs kind of northeast along the edge of the highway there, and Robin Hood Hills butts up against it. So they drove down this because there was a building down there that was being rebuilt, and they thought that maybe the boys had gotten out that way and something had happened. They'd been hurt or unable to leave, although they did not find anything. After this, the trio returned back to the house, with Hudson informing them that they needed to rest for a little bit. He was going to go back out and continue looking for the boys. Byers estimated the time at this point to be 2 or 3 o'clock. After this, the Byers family really just kind of camps out for the night because they're all exhausted. They're besides themselves with fear over what has happened or what may have happened, and there's really nothing they can do because it's just too dark outside to continue looking, given the fact that they did not have any real equipment beyond some borrowed flashlights to find the boys. Byers' account later goes on to state that come daylight, there's a knock at the Byers family home, and Terry Hobbs is there, Dana and Todd Moore, who had returned from work, along with Stevie Branch Sr. Now we're going to jump into Terry Hobbs. We already discussed how after he did not arrive at 4:30, the family drove around looking for him for a few moments before Terry drove Pam to her job. Now, Hobbs did not give an official police statement until June 21st of 2007, but this statement does line up fairly well with statements that he gave at that point in time on May 5th and the days and months afterwards when the bodies had discovered. He stated that his day began at roughly 5:30 a.m. as he drove an ice cream truck over a very broad geographical location. And he usually got home around 3 or 3:30 in the afternoon. Terry stated that upon arriving home that afternoon, he found Pam and their daughter Amanda at the house, but no Stevie. He further stated that after finding this, he walked out into the driveway to see if he could find the young boy, but was unable to locate him. So the three of them went out to drop Pam off at work, doing their search along the way. After dropping Pam off at work, Terry and Amanda continued their search, stopping at the Moore household to see if they had seen the boys. It was informed that they were out riding bicycles, and according to Terry, he and the young Amanda continued to drive around for quote-unquote probably 30 minutes. Should be pointed out that Terry Hobbs was uncertain about the times, which is understandable given the fact that when he gave this interview, 14 years had passed. I know there's people out there who have this insane idea in their head that something so major in your life, you should remember every single detail. The human mind does not work that way. I don't care who you are. That is just reality. Up until the frickin' boys went missing, it was just another day. And once things really got rolling, I can promise you they were not looking at the clock to, you know, notate that at, you know, 8:05 we encountered blah 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 blah. While searching, Terry and Amanda encountered Dana Moore, who asked if he had seen Michael, if Michael was at their home. It was at this point that Terry informed her that Stevie was also missing. Terry followed Dana back to their home, where they questioned Dawn Moore, who said that she had seen the boys drive by on their bicycles. Hobbs also stated during this official statement that this was the first time he had encountered John Mark Byers, whom he described as a, quote, big bully-looking dude. It's at this point that they realized that all three boys are together. Hobbs said they spoke about calling the police, and because he wanted to get out there and continue searching, he assumed that Dana Moore would make the call to the police. After leaving the Moore household, Hobbs stated that he drove around for a short period of time before dropping Amanda off at the Jacoby household. David Jacoby agreed to help Terry look for the boys. On June 21st, 2007, Jacoby gave his first full interview to the police, and he did vary in some areas from the story that Terry Hobbs told, but again, that's to be expected given the length of time that had passed and the fact that, well, yes, it was tragic for everyone in the area that these three boys had gone missing and were later found murdered. These were not Jacoby's children. He was only tangentially involved in this, and this idea again that, you know, these people should remember every single detail in crystal clear clarity, it's one of those Hollywood myths. According to Jacoby, Hobbs came over with Aranda between 5:30 and 6. The two men played guitars together for a little while. Jacoby estimated this to be about an hour before Hobbs left to go look for Stevie, and that Terry had returned a few more times throughout the evening. Quoting from this interview, Jacoby stated, "I went with him to look for the kids. We rode down the road towards, I think, that's Barton Street, going out towards those apartment where, what's the place there's Robin Hood apartment, whatever they call it. I'm just not really not sure. I mean, if was, I know at one time me and him did go look then. His wife had come by, and she was hysterical. We wound up walking through those woods with her dad and some people, was from out that neighborhood. I was out until like 3 o'clock that morning with them. Not all together. Everybody was kind of branched off. Jacoby did state that it was close to dark by the time that he joined the search. He recalled going into the woods and seeing footprints, bicycle tire prints in the ditch, and muddy footprints along the pipe bridge. He also recalled seeing John Mark Byers, Terry Hobbs, Jackie Hicks Sr., along with other individuals whose names he could not recall, calling the children by name. There was also a police officer involved in this search. When asked about Hobbs's demeanor on that evening, Jacoby stated that his friend was low-key, but that is just how he is, and anybody who has ever had an encounter with Terry Hobbs will tell you that. He's not one of these individuals to get hysterical and start screaming. He's a very low-key individual. I do want to make mention of the fact that Jacoby did change his story. On June 25th, after he had given this statement to the police, he gave a statement for a defamation lawsuit that Hobbs had filed against the insufferable lead singer of the Dixie Chicks, stating that he believed Hobbs had come over between 5 and 5:30, although it could possibly have been 6 p.m., and that he had seen Stevie Branch and two other little boys riding their bikes with one on the skateboard outside of his home, although he could not give a time frame for this, and that he and Hobbs had played guitars for up to an hour between 6 and 6:30, and that Hobbs had told him when they got finished playing that he was going to see if Stevie had gotten home, and that Stevie was expected home before dark. Now, in the statement he gave to police, Jacoby was unable to recall whether or not Amanda had been left with he and his wife when Terry left the house. However, during this statement, he said that he was 90% sure Amanda had been left with them. Jacoby went on to further state that when Hobbs did return, he asked if Stevie had been by, and it was at this point that he agreed to go with Terry to look for the boys before Terry drove him back to the home and dropped David Jacoby off. Terry stating that he's going to go look for the boys and that they had gone out together again 2 to 3 more times. Terry brought Jacoby back to the home yet again so that Jacoby could change his clothing and get flashlights so that they could go look for the boys further. Jacoby stated that Terry took Amanda with him and did not return. He also stated that he got back involved with the search because Pam Hicks showed up at the house looking for Stevie, and the two of them ended up leaving together to go look for the boys. It was at this point that they met up with the other searchers, including Terry Hobbs. If you believe the West Memphis 3 truthers that, you know, that Terry Hobbs is in fact guilty for this, Jacoby places Terry Hobbs at his house anywhere from 5 up to 6:30. So he has an hour and a half to restrain and murder these three boys, and depending on the particular narrative you're following, either placing their bodies inside of a manhole cover and going back later to place their bodies in the water, or going down, putting the bodies in the water, and then returning home and getting cleaned up enough so that he can encounter the rest of them at 8 o'clock. All without being seen by anybody covered in mud or in the presence of the boys. Moreover, nobody has ever placed the vehicle owned by Terry Hobbs during this period of time anywhere near Robin Hood Hills. which is important as Hobbs would have had to transport the children down there somehow. He's going to bind all of these children and carry them down there by himself, or he's going to march them down there, or even better yet, he saw the boys going into the woods and then followed them down there. Yet I know there's another story out there. We're going to get into that when we get into the bullshit lies and alibis chapter of this case involving Hobbs and a gay orgy. One thing is important, though. While their times do not match up exactly, nor does the sequence of events, they both state that they were with one another multiple times that evening. Hobbs also stated that he had not been aware of Robin Hood Hills, as he was not at home most of the time during the day, and when he was home, he had other things to occupy his time, until being informed by bystanders that boys had been seen going into the woods. He described Robin Hood Hills as, quote, the jungle. I couldn't see 8-year-old boys hanging around. We do know that Hobbs entered Robin Hood Hills with Officer Meek, and that the two of them left fairly quickly because it was hot, filled with mosquitoes, and extremely muggy. There are versions where Hobbs and Jacoby went down into the woods at 6 or 6:30, although none of that can be verified. I know the people that freaking believe they're not guilty are going to say, well, this proved that he had time and that his whole story is fabricated. I'm not seeing it. There's no basis of fact or evidence to prove that Terry Hobbs had anything to do with these murders, and I'm quite frankly amazed that he has not filed lawsuits against those who are screaming at the top of their lungs that he is guilty of this. The only reason I think he probably has not is because Terry Hobbs suffered through all of this and more likely than not has decided that he needs to move on with his life for himself rather than dwell on what has been said about him and allow it to rule his life as some others involved in this case have done. We do know Terry Hobbs went back to pick up Pam from work, I believe it was about 9:30, and that he informed her that Stevie had not come home and she became hysterical, and that a call to the police was made from the restaurant concerning the missing boy. We do know that for much of the rest of the night, Hobbs, Pam, as well as eventually Stevie Branch Sr. were looking for the boys. Hobbs did state that he saw a quote-unquote black bum coming from that area along the service road who was wet and disgusting looking, and that he did, in fact, remember this bum because he was coming from that area. Another key point with Terry Hobbs is he flat out says that he kept searching all night, as did Pam, and that the next morning they went to the school to see if any of the three boys showed up. In every statement interview with Terry Hobbs I've ever seen, and this has been corroborated by others, Hobbs is out there looking for the boys, sometimes by himself, more often than not with others in tow. So there we have the timeline of events for May 5th going into May 6th. We're going to cover now more on May 5th, and this is from the point of view of Jesse Miss Kelly. This is the story he gave with all of his admissions removed, as well as his inconsistencies and lies removed, because by the time he finally got to the Bible confession and then confessing to prosecutors after that, again against the wishes of his lawyer, Miss Kelly's story had changed significantly in that he began being what is seen as being more truthful, but he also began putting himself more in the picture as just kind of, you know, a hired thug, so to speak. Or more truthfully, an unwitting accessory to murder. Out of all of the killers, I will say this, I don't believe Jesse Miss Kelly understood the night of May 5th that the three of them were going out to murder three boys. I honestly don't think that he would have been okay with that. Miss Kelly stated numerous times that he went with the two other boys under the idea that they were going to go and beat some kids up. According to Miss Kelly, he had been at the trailer parks and a neighbor had purchased him a bottle of Evan Williams whiskey, which he placed into the back pocket of his pants before heading out from the Highland Park trailer park to Lakeshore, where he was supposed to meet up with Jason Baldwin. According again to Miss Kelly, Baldwin had called him earlier in that week to convince him to come and hang out with him on Wednesday, with the idea of they were going to go into West Memphis and find some kids to beat up. Miss Kelly stated that when he got to Lakeshore, he found both Damien Eccles and Jason Baldwin, both of whom he was well acquainted with, waiting for him on the road. Miss Kelly said that Jason had just gotten done cutting the lawn at his uncle's house. And that's a part of Jason Baldwin's story that has never changed, really, over the years. He always states that he was cutting the lawn of his uncle up to about, I believe it was 4:35-ish, somewhere around there. But again, according to Miss Kelly, after meeting up with the other two boys, they walked roughly 2 miles to the woods behind the Blue Beacon truck wash. And the three of them hung out drinking while they waited for some children to come down there. Eccles has stated numerous times that he did not know anything about the Robin Hood Hills area. However, his own statements to police prior to all the hoopla over their supposed innocence tell a different story. Damien walked everywhere in town. At one point, he had lived not far from it, and he even told police that he walked through there numerous times a week. Jesse stated that as they sat there and drank, as with darkness falling, the three boys entered the woods. Damien spotted them first and ordered both Jesse and Jason to hide, while Damien hid and began making noises in order to draw the boys' attention. When the three boys got close, the teens jumped out and began assaulting them. Fairly quickly, the boys were subdued, with shirts being shoved inside of their mouths to help muffle any screams that weren't already being muffled by the embankment that they were in, as well as the nearby interstate. Jesse primarily focused on Michael Moore, who at one point attempted to escape, although Jesse ran him down and beat him into unconsciousness. It was at this point that the boy's clothing was removed and Jason pulled out a knife, cutting a large wound into the side of Stevie's face, before turning his attention to Christopher, who Jason castrated with the knife. It should be noted that Christopher bled out on the embankment. Jason and Damien began sexually abusing the boys, stating that at times Damien would get behind one of the boys as though he were performing anal sex on them, and at other points that Jason put one of the boys' penises in his mouth. He did state that they ejaculated over the boys and onto their pants before Damien urinated inside of their mouths. After this, the boys were bound using shoelaces, left wrist to left ankle, right wrist to right ankle, after which point the boys were carried down into the water, by Damien and Jason. Jesse has never changed this particular part of his story, in that he did run from the scene. Earlier confessions, he placed the time that he fled the scene as being much earlier in the assault, but eventually he settled on the fact that he left when the boys had been placed in the water or around the time that they were being placed into the water. Jesse stated that he ran to an underpass and was sick underneath it, and out of anger that he had been pulled into this type of activity, he broke his Evan Williams whiskey bottle against the concrete before walking home. After returning home, Jesse stated that Jason had called him to demand to know why he had left their little party so early. However, Jesse never really stated what he told Jason as to his reason for leaving. He stated that he arrived home around 9. Now, Damien was spotted walking along the service road near the crime scene in muddy clothing at 9:30 p.m. that night. He was witnessed by individuals who we'll talk about probably in the next episode, in the company of someone with long blonde hair who this individual assumed was Damien's girlfriend, Dominique Teer. However, if you look at pictures of Jason Baldwin from 1993, from a distance, it would be very easy to misidentify him as a girl. And I'm pointing this out now, Damien Eccles cut a very striking image in the town of West Memphis. He was not someone that anyone who was familiar with him would mistake for another person. We are going to call the episode now for the week. Next week, we're going to get into the events of May 6th and discuss the discovery of the bodies as well as the things that happened after that. I hope you have enjoyed this week's episode. Again, if you like the show, please go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe, leave a 5-star review. Consider becoming a Patreon member over at tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon. Till next week, The Death Cast is a production of Corpse Creek Publishing in association with Big Pond Podcasts. Stay morbid!